Here are the stories we're covering this week in the Category 5.tv newsroom. Thanks to robots and automation in the U.S., Africa is at risk. U.S. cities are starting to crack down on commercial crypto mining due to the heavy load it puts on their power grid. An autonomous flying taxi is coming to New Zealand, and 3D printed homes for the less fortunate. These stories are coming right up. Don't go anywhere.
Whether you shop on ThinkGeek, GearBest, B&H Photo Video, eBay, or Amazon, or even if you want a free trial of Audible, you'll find the best deals and support the shows we produce by simply visiting the shopping sites you already frequent by using the links on our website. Visit category5.tv/partners for the full and ever-growing list and help us create more free content like this show. Thank you for shopping with our partners, and thank you for watching.
This is the Category5.tv newsroom, covering the week's top tech stories with a slight Linux bias.
I'm Sasha Rickman, and here are the top stories we're following this week. Within less than two decades, it will be cheaper to operate robots in the U.S.-based factories than to hire workers in Africa, a new report warns. Falling automation costs are predicted to cause job losses as manufacturers return to richer economies. Though some analysts say poorer countries could be less impacted by this trend, the Overseas Development Institute suggests otherwise. Its report, however, does add that African nations do have time to prepare for the change. Karishma Banga, a senior research officer at ODI, says African countries must not shy away from manufacturing, but instead prepare by increasing access to internet, investing in technical skills, and promoting technological innovation. Dirk Wellem de Velde, director of the Supporting Economics Transformation Program at ODI, said in a statement, "Currently, the cost of operating robots in furniture manufacturing is still higher than labor, but this will not be the case within 15 years." Their report found that in the furniture manufacturing, the cost of operating robots and 3D printers in the U.S. will be cheaper than Kenyan wages by 2034. And in Ethiopia, ODI predicts that robotic automation will be cheaper than Ethiopian workers between 2038 and 2042. This gives the continent between one and two decades to build up its capabilities in sectors that are less at risk of automation, such as food and beverages, garments, metal, and metals, the report writes. It advises African nations to expand access to broadband and develop locals' technical skills through vocational training, technology hubs, and a bigger focus on STEM subjects in African educational bodies.
Okay.
Wow. So we kind of saw this coming, I would say.
Truthfully, from our...
Yeah.
I didn't. But that
I didn't ever think of it. I didn't give it a second thought, and now it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Well, I mean, we think about it from our own backyard. I mean, you look at how technology is changing things here, but I didn't think about the other countries, and I know that sounds very self-centric, but I don't know if I've ever paid attention. What do we get from Africa, from a man? I know it talked about food and metal.
Furniture is a very good example where like 75% of the furniture that's manufactured is exported. Not necessarily to Canada here. I'm not sure what the percentages are, but definitely you think about like the UK.
Right, a lot of Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So a lot of it ends up there. Mm-hmm. So if the U.S. is able to manufacture it more cheaply, all of a sudden this becomes a problem. So in Africa, definitely furniture is one. Ethiopia, you're looking at apparel, shoes, for example.
It reminds me of the story we just covered a couple of weeks ago with the jeans, with
Levi's, the laser jeans.
Right. So this laser is where jeans. This is where I seem to see the trend where technology is taking the load off of labor jobs, but our labor jobs are generally outsourced to other countries because labor is expensive here and cheap there. As soon as we don't need to have people laboring, instead it's robots, of course, why not have them here as opposed to there? Right?
Like
it makes sense.
Less shipping.
Right? So now the onus is really on these countries to to find another way.
This is a tough situation too, because you know, as I'm thinking about this more and more, and you can comment below if you're watching this online, if you're watching this on cable TV, send us an email through our website. But would a fear not be that, okay, now if it becomes so cheap to manufacture it through robotics, through automation, and we think about slave labor and we do care about the conditions in these factories in Ethiopia and in China, and what happens if now all of a sudden wages have to go down because costs have to go down? Or what if conditions, which are already poorly, have to become worse in order for these companies to compete? So there's a whole other aspect to this where, you know, maybe regulations, there's that word again, why do I bring up regulations? But does America have to say, we need to care more about the world as a whole, be careful while we're approaching this, regulate the manufacturers and say, look, we need to make sure that if you're going to automate, that you need to follow these best practices in order to protect the families and the individuals who are currently manufacturing these in third world and, and poorly conditions.
Wouldn't it be great if they could implement more STEM training for...
Oh, absolutely. Right?
And that's what I liked about that story. Is it did say, you know, more STEM training in the education program. And I mean, I think it's great. I do.
Well, that helps the next generation.
Absolutely.
But what does it do for the folks that right now, have, if they lose their jobs, have nothing?
That's a great question.
And that's a question just to put out there. There's no answer to that.
Yeah.
And it is just a question. And it... I don't know the answer.
Yeah. Nor do I. Time will tell.
Yeah. That's right.
U.S. cities are starting to crack down on commercial crypto mining due to the heavy load it puts on their power grid. A city in upstate New York has become the first in America to effectively ban any new commercial-grade cryptocurrency miners from powering up. Mayor Colin Redd and the City Council of Plattsburgh this month signed off on a measure to place an 18-month moratorium on any new industrial-scale crypto coin crafting operations within city limits. Altcash mining companies typically require a permit to operate within Plattsburgh. Now, no more applications will be approved for a full year and a half. Located on the banks of Lake Champlain, near the Canadian border, Plattsburgh has a population of 19,000 people and is a hot spot for boating and bass fishing. Its proximity to the lake also means that Plattsburgh is able to enjoy low-cost hydroelectric power, making it extremely attractive to large-scale crypto mining operations. As Reg readers know, altcoin crafting rigs can be tremendous power hogs. So when those mining operations came to town, the normally cheap power became more expensive due to the soaring demand, and residents saw their electric bills climb by an average of $10 apiece in January alone. Just two of the registered miners accounted for around 10 to 15% of the city's entire power consumption. Now, to slow down the power slurp, Plattsburgh has decided to block any new operations until at least the fall of 2019. Existing crypto coin mining outfits will be allowed to stay for the time being. Those who violate the new law will be subject to fines of up to $1,000 per day. The city notes that during the moratorium, it will look into whether a long-term zoning and power law on crypto coin mining is needed. Meanwhile, New York State has ruled that high-density load customers, or crypto miners, if you read between the lines, face rising electricity bills due to the pressure they place on electric supply grids.
This is interesting.
Another thing, I didn't see that coming.
Well, yeah, I mean, and because I'm just getting into mining cryptocurrency myself from, you know, at home with consumer grade, you know, products, I haven't seen the impact of a large scale power drain at my house, so to speak. So the idea that there's companies out there that are using such a high power demand that it's causing the citizens of the town to see an increase in the power bills kind of baffles me, because I know if my energy goes up at my house, I'm paying the bill.
Yeah.
So why aren't they just getting the bill themselves, and instead it's being distributed to everybody?
Well, here's one consideration, is that it is hydroelectric, so it's water-powered electricity. Yeah. So there, it's a finite resource, so would they not have to bring in more power to the grid if they've exceeded the surplus right. and the flow of what the generators are capable of, right? So the costs right. go up.
But then put that on the company. You read there...
To some degree, sure.
Yeah, you read that the two companies were 10 to 15% of the power usage alone. So take the city's power bill and give them 10 to 15%. You know, and...
Yeah.
I don't know that it's that easy.
It would be nice if it was that easy
right?
to say, hey,
yeah.
it's your company that's doing this, so you're the one who gets... But I think it has to do with the whole grid and the whole network of the electrical mm-hmm. grid and the cost to produce the energy required by that region mm-hmm. has gone up, and so it affects all of the users.
Right.
Now, the user who is crypto mining with this massive, like we're talking server farm here, right?
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
They're going to be paying the most of that bill, but yep. it's still going to impact other folks as the overall cost to operate has gone up. Maybe more man hours are required because more people are required to operate the hydroelectric station and the electricity coming into the town.
Right. Mm-hmm. And am I correct in assuming home cryptocurrency mining is not banned? It's just the larger ones,
no,
right?
No, it's just industrial.
It's just yeah. industrial.
These are companies that open up specifically to mine.
Yeah,
and this is people are making money off of this because they're, and this is why I can't mine Bitcoin. This is why you can't mine Bitcoin
right,
on your
yeah.
consumer gear, because these companies build a network in a rental unit or something
right.
or a lease a unit, and they draw on the electrical system and they mine so
powerful
much
machines.
With so much power that us little guys just can't.
My
can't
Raspberry
compete.
Pi won't cut it.
Right.
No. My mining rig, which is sitting over there, and you can see all the video cards, and it's not going to cut it.
This is right. a conversation I would have never imagined that we would ever be having. Because cryptocurrency is new,
yes.
right? This blows my mind that this is yeah. a real problem.
See,
and it is.
What I love, though, and I mean, I get this deviates a little bit from the news, but a month ago, cryptocurrency was a foreign concept. I mean, I knew what it was, but how it worked, I didn't understand. Mm-hmm. And just in the last month of exploring it and starting to do it myself at home, I now get it. And I'm going, oh, this is fun.
Where were you all my life?
Exactly. Why wasn't I doing this years ago?
When Bitcoin first came out,
yeah, so
it was easy to mine a Bitcoin.
Yeah, so I can see the appeal to setting up a company, getting the hardware
oh, yes.
in place,
oh, yes.
and just... blowing through the mining to really yeah. hook on to some of this cash and this new trend that's going.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's cities do have to turn their mind to this sort of thing.
Sure.
You know, what happens?
It's a new business model that draws a lot on the electricity
yeah.
of that. Like, we're not talking consumer gear. Sure, you're running your computer and it's using your electricity, but it's still just your computer.
Right.
Okay. We're talking server farms that are running at 100% CPU and GPU all the time, 24/7, with 300,000 computers and, you know, just ridiculous.
Well, they should be using their money to invest in some green energy ideas.
That's a good idea. Yeah. And that's why people are building them in places that are super cold so they don't have to cool it.
But
right.
it's possible, like the amount of output that the green sources, maybe solar, wind, whatever, may not be enough to actually run it all.
Well, right. let's
like
think
that's
of
how much
else.
Hardware there is. Oh, I totally agree.
Right.
So, but
or maybe they're just like Cyril Sneer, and they just are mining. They're just mining.
Oh my goodness, raccoons! That is a throwback TV show.
I could totally see him mining cryptocurrency.
Oh, totally, absolutely,
absolutely.
Yeah, or Scrooge McDuck. I can
yeah,
see
absolutely,
that too.
Oh,
absolutely.
My.
Where was mining when he was around?
Oh. A new air taxi service was financially backed by Google co-founder Larry Page is set to take off in New Zealand thanks to an agreement announced last week. Paige's Kitty Hawk Company, the developer of a new autonomous flying machine called Cora, will begin testing the service in rural Canterbury, a region in the South Island. The electric air taxi can carry two passengers. It is designed to take off like a helicopter and uses proprietary software to fly like a regular fixed-wing aircraft with the help of some human supervision. Zephyr Airworks, Kitty Hawk's New Zealand affiliate, has been working with government officials on plans to test the new service as part of a program meant to encourage science and innovation in the country. Despite the high interest in development, the business case for fully autonomous air taxis is not as strong as one might think, suggested Stephen Polzin. Polzin is the director of mobility policy research at the University of South Florida's Center for Urban Transportation Research. He says, for passenger air travel, particularly commercial air travel, the labor cost associated with pilots is relatively modest in the context of total cost providing the trip, which dampens the motivation to go to full automation.
Oh, I gotcha.
Right?
That makes sense, yeah.
That makes sense to me, right?
Because the wages of the pilot is pale in comparison to the fuel and the jet itself. And,
right.
Sure, yeah.
But if it's one element you can take out of the equation, it's one less payload for having the driver, therefore less fuel consumption, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. When I'm listening to this, the first question that's popping up in my head is this necessary? Are we going to need air taxi? And
I have seen some videos for what the traffic's like in New York City. I feel like maybe.
Well, that's the thing. I'm thinking about it. I'm going, okay, I commute every day to work. I'm on the road, depending on traffic and weather, between an hour to 2.5 hours.
So cut 45 minutes off of that.
Right. But then I'm also going, okay, in traffic, there's road rage. And if you're sitting there and you're watching some guy go and go across traffic in this air taxi, I'm thinking about what's the impact going to be on somebody who's on a motorcycle and the air downstream from the...
I would theorize that it would be up a little higher than...
So then we have the issue of air traffic control, because in at least the regulations...
It's autonomous, Jeff. It'll move.
But here's the thing. So for flights in, I think, just Ontario, I don't know about other areas, but we have a cap of 100 feet. You cannot fly a commercial aircraft less than 100 feet from any structure top.
Okay. Right. I'm picturing in my mind that this is just a taxi sort of thing where it's like in one city, like short distances. It's not a commute to Toronto, right? It's like...
To get across a busy city.
Not tabletop, but like rooftop to rooftop maybe. Like, hey, I'm going from my condo
I'm
here
Bruce
to...
Wayne.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I'm picturing short distances. It's probably not going to be too much of an issue as far as air traffic control and things like
that. Sure, and can I just say along that vein, Jeff believes they can build an autonomous robotic airborne taxi, but they can't figure out air traffic control.
No, that's not what I said. I said there's a need for it.
Worked that into the equation of the autonomous programming.
Maybe.
They must. But I'm with Sasha on this. I think it's probably like building to building across New York City.
Yeah, I believe
but still, you're going to need something. Because, if you've got, I think of Toronto, we have Orange Air Ambulance. So you've got an ambulance that's right. It lands on the rooftop of the hospital.
Yeah.
And, hey, you've got 15 minutes to get to that accident scene, 60 kilometers up the road. And so it's like, helicopter's gone. And if you got some taxi in the way that's not
linked helicopter, up. Helicopter needs a landing pad.
It does, yes.
A two-person taxi?
Yeah.
Maybe not so much.
But I bet you that thing's going to be close to the size of a car, footprint-wise.
Sure, absolutely.
Right. That's still huge.
But the same as a car pulls off to the side of the road when an ambulance comes, this air taxi would probably divert its path, and get out of the way. I am pro-air taxi.
And as things grow, just to my final thought is as things grow into the autonomous era, the autonomous vehicles on the road will know, here comes the air taxi. It's about to come down. Back up. let her in.
That's if everything's integrated. It's also autonomous,
and it's all integrated. It's all working together in the same mesh network and saying, okay, he's about to come down and land in the middle of the highway.
Okay, so I know you said that was your last thought.
That's my last thought.
So if they're all integrated, one hack attack, and it's done.
Always put a dark spin on it, Jeff.
No, we covered security measures a couple shows ago.
Of course.
I think it was last week. Think security.
Yeah. They need to work it into the
network. That's the point.
For sure. They need to.
Get the security solid, then roll it out.
Okay.
So maybe that's the part with the human supervision, where it said with some human supervision.
Maybe.
Yeah.
No. No.
Bad taxi.
Don't hack that.
I'm really pro air taxi. I love this.
I got it.
In Texas, tucked behind a house for the wealthy, there may lie some hope for the significantly less fortunate. More than a billion people in the world go to sleep each night without reliable shelter. But a pair of companies working on solving that believes that their model of quickly 3D printing a one-story house could not only provide a roof over the head, but a genuinely great place to live. It's a proof of concept built by Icon, a construction firm, and NewStory, a nonprofit that sets up houses in the developing world. The 380 square foot dwelling required about $10,000 or 7,000 pounds of concrete and took 48 hours. Eventually, the goal is to build a 650 square foot version and to bring down the cost significantly by using a mixture of economies of scale. Economies of scale, like buying concrete in bulk, and improvements to the 3D printing machine. The goal build time is between 12 and 24 hours. Later this year, the project will head to El Salvador to build some test homes with the view to begin work on a community of 100 houses in 2019. If it does work, it would literally change how shelter is created, said Brett Hagler, chief executive and co-founder of NewStory. It's irresponsible for us not to try it. Like small-scale 3D printing, the system works by slowly adding material layer by layer. In this case, that material is mortar, similar to concrete. The height and width of the house is constrained by the size of an enormous metal frame, which operates autonomously once given its instructions. With the machine, they can print up to 11 feet tall. The robot follows blueprints created using typical CAD software. This means homeowners would have the ability to create their own designs on site or pick from a library of possible configurations.
Cool.
Hagler believed the machines will be operated by local construction workers, and it is hoped that the lower cost of each unit would in turn mean more demand for more houses to be built.
That's so great.
Yeah.
I love when technology is used to help people.
Yes.
I know.
And the price point of it was really quite cheap as well. The fact that it was $10,000, and that's at current rates.
Sure.
Now, granted, that doesn't include, you know, whatever the rig is that you're going to have to recover your cost of buying it and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it might be that maybe it's $15,000 for the home. But who's going to be paying for it?
That's what's so genius about this foundation that they've set up, right?
Right. But then you also have the land.
Sure.
So it's not just the building, but it's the land. So where does the land come from? Who's going to buy the land?
Right, right.
All this kind of stuff.
And I think I know what you're asking, because, like, okay, we're helping impoverished folks.
Right.
How will they pay for this?
Right.
That's what's smart about it, because what they've done is they've set it up so that, first of all, a lot of donations are going into this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So Silicon Valley in particular is investing by donating in this organization.
Okay.
So then they're going in and building these houses using these 3D printers, and they're not giving them away. They're selling them to the individuals. But here's the catch. They're doing it at what would equate to about $30 a month in our dollars.
Right.
Wow.
So they're giving them a mortgage that works out to be about $30 a month. They're doing it interest-free.
Oh, cool.
They're doing it with no profit. And then, to take it one step further, now to keep the momentum going, that $30, if you will, just to put a number out there that equates into, you know, Canadian terms, that money is now put into a trust.
Okay? Oh, okay.
So now they're building up this trust so that they can now build homes for other people and then do it again.
Right.
And keep paying it forward and paying it forward from these initial donations that have made it possible.
Very cool.
So, I love it.
Yeah. And so now these folks who could never afford to mortgage a house are mortgaging a house.
Right.
See, and it's manageable.
That's neat. Mm-hmm. I like that.
I actually really love that they're small homes too.
Sure. Yeah.
I do. I like everything about it, right? Because
next gen and, you know, hey, let's take this to Mars and like all so much potential.
Well, I mean, when you let's be clear. You look at the homes that we've got in developed countries and around here. I mean, I drive past, you know, $6 million homes that are 10,000 square feet and I'm going,
why?
Yeah, like you've got a family of four living there. Mm-hmm. You know, but when, right. I mean, I've spent time in Guatemala and Mexico, Dominican, doing humanitarian work. In a lot of cases, their homes are 100, 200 square right. feet, and there's like six of them.
Yeah.
Right. So to give them something that's, I think it was 400 or 600 square feet, they're going to have so much room for activities.
Sure.
You know, it's going to be right. fun.
I mean, truth be told, the bigger your house is, the more you feel like you need to fill it with stuff.
Right.
The smaller your house
Western
is.
Western world, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you have a smaller house, I think that all of a sudden your attentions are on more important things, like getting out and
right.
not...
Right. It's your living space. It's
right.
your sleeping space. It's your shelter.
Yeah.
But then
home ownership for somebody who isn't able to afford a mortgage. Mm-hmm. Right? And a concrete structure for, you know, in a spot where perhaps there isn't that sort of material used for the normal house. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I was talking about the humanitarian work. When I was in the Dominican, that's what we did. We built homes. So we went, there was a community that we designated where we're talking like metal sides, just find a piece of metal, mm-hmm. putting it up. Sometimes palm leaves, like that's literally what it was. Hurricane comes through, it's gone.
Gone, yeah.
So what we did is we started with one home. Mm-hmm. You build this one home, cinder block foundation, concrete floor, mm-hmm. and it was bigger than what they had. And so then their idea, because of the community minded, was, hey, this is our home. Your home's next. You come live with us while we tear down your shack
we
build you another home.
Yep.
Right. And then you've got two homes, and both those homes go, hey, yours is the next house. Come live with us. And so the community starts taking in the other homes that are, you know, so everybody's got a place to stay. So something like this, I'm going, this is amazing. Give them a little bit bigger footprint to live in and start inviting some of the rest of the community. And as we build those homes, I love it.
Cool.
Love this idea.
Mm-hmm. Big thanks to Roy W. Nash and our community of viewers for submitting stories to us this week. Thanks for watching the Category5.tv newsroom. Don't forget to like and subscribe for all your tech news with a slight Linux bias. And for more free content, be sure to check out our website. From the Category5.tv newsroom, I'm Sasha Rickman.
And I'm Robbie Ferguson.
And I'm Jeff Weston.